Chapter 23. Already possessed that authority, she meant to clothe herself with power, despotic and unchallengeable, to appoint all science readers to their offices, both at home and abroad. The phrase, "are to appoint," is another miscarriage of intention. She did not mean "are," she meant "and." That by law puts into Mrs. Eddy's hands absolute command over the most formidable force and influence existent in the Christian Science kingdom outside of herself, and it does this unconditionally, and, by auxiliary force of laws already quoted, irrevocably. Still, she is not quite satisfied. Something might happen, she doesn't know what. Therefore she drives in one more nail, to make sure, and drives it deep. This by-law can neither be amended nor annulled, except by consent of the pastor emeritus. Let someone with a wild and delirious fancy try, and see if he can imagine her furnishing that consent. Monopoly of spiritual bread, very properly, the first qualification for membership in the Mother-Church's belief in the doctrines of Christian Science. But these doctrines must not be gathered from secondary sources. There is but one recognized source. The candidate must be a believer in the doctrines of Christian Science, according to the platform and teaching contained in the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health, with key to the scriptures, apostrophe by Rev. Mary Baker G. Eddy. That is definite, and is final. There are to be no commentaries, no labored volumes of exposition and explanation by anybody except Mrs. Eddy. Because such things could sow error, create warring opinions, split the religion in two sects, and disastrously cripple its power. Mrs. Eddy will do the whole of the explaining, herself has done it, in fact. S. He has written several books. They are to be had for cash in advance, they are all sacred. Additions to them can never be needed, and will never be permitted. They tell the candidate how to instruct himself, how to teach others, how to do all things comprised in the business, and they close the door against all would-be competitors, and monopolize the trade. The Bible and the above-named book, Science and Health, with other works by the same author, must be his only textbooks for the commerce he cannot forge outside. Mrs. Eddy's words are to be the sole elucidators of the Bible and Science and Health forever. Throughout the ages, whenever there is doubt as to the meaning of a passage in either of these books, the inquirer will not dream of trying to explain it to himself. He would shudder at the thought of such temerity, such profanity. He would be haled to the Inquisition, and thence to the public square and the stake, if he should be caught studying in two text meanings on his own hook. He will be prudent, and seek the meanings at the only permitted source, Mrs. Eddy's commentaries. Value of this straitjacket. One must not underrate the magnificence of this long-headed idea. One must not underestimate its giant possibilities in the matter of trooping the church solidly together, and keeping it so. It squelches independent inquiry, and makes such a thing impossible, profane, criminal. It authoritatively settles every dispute that can arise. It starts with finality a point which the Roman Church has traveled towards 15 or 16 centuries, stage by stage, and has not yet reached. The matter of the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary was not authoritatively settled until the days of Pius IX. Yesterday, so to speak. As already noticed, the Protestants are broken up into a long array of sects, a result of disputes about the meanings of texts, disputes made unavoidable by the absence of an infallible authority to submit doubtful passages to. A week or two ago, I am writing in the middle of January, 1903, the clergy and others hereabouts had a warm dispute in the papers over this question. Did Jesus anywhere claim to be God? It seemed an easy question, but it turned out to be a hard one. It was ably and elaborately discussed by learned men of several denominations, but in the end it remained unsettled. A week ago, another discussion broke out. It was over this text. Sell all that thou hast, and distribute unto the poor. One verdict was worded as follows. When Christ answered the rich young man, and said for him to give to the poor all he possessed, or he could not gain everlasting life, he did not mean it in the literal sense. My interpretation of his words is that we should part with what comes between us and Christ. There is no doubt that Jesus believed that the rich young man thought more of his wealth than he did of his soul, and, such being the case, it was his duty to give up the wealth. Every one of us knows that there is something we should give up for Christ. Those who are true believers and followers know what they have given up, and those who are not yet followers know down in their hearts what they must give up. 10 clergymen of various denominations were interviewed, and 9 of them agreed with that verdict. That did not settle the matter, because the 10th said the language of Jesus was so straight and definite that it explained itself: colon sell all, not a percentage. There is a most unusual feature about that dispute. The 9 persons who decided alike quoted not a single authority in support of their position. I do not know when I have seen trained disputants do the like of that before. The 9 merely furnished their own opinions, founded upon nothing at all. In the other dispute, did Jesus anywhere claim to be God? The same kind of men, trained and learned clergymen, backed up their arguments with chapter and verse. On both sides, plenty of verses. Were no reinforcing verses to be found in the present case? It looks that way. The opinion of the 9 seems strange to me, for it is unsupported by authority, while there was at least constructive authority for the opposite view. It is hair-splitting differences of opinion over disputed text meanings that have divided in too many sects a once united church. One may infer from some of the names in the following list that some of the differences are very slight, so slight as to be not distinctly important. Perhaps, yet they have moved groups to withdraw from communions to which they belonged, and set up a sect of their own. The list, accompanied by various church statistics for 1902, compiled by Rev. Dr. H. K. Carroll, was published January 8, 1903, in the New York Christian Advocate. Adventists, 6 bodies, Baptists, 13 bodies, Brethren, Plymouth, 4 bodies, Brethren, River, 3 bodies, Catholics, 8 bodies, Catholic Apostolic, Christadelphians, Christian Connection, Christian Catholics, Christian Missionary Association, Christian Scientists, Church of God, Weinbrennerian, Church of the New Jerusalem, Congregationalists, Disciples of Christ, Dunkards, 4 bodies, Evangelical, 2 bodies, Friends, 4 bodies, Friends of the Temple, German Evangelical Protestant, German Evangelical Synod, Independent Congregations, Jews, 2 bodies, Latter-day Saints, 2 bodies, Lutherans, 22 bodies, Mennonites, 12 bodies, Comma Methodists, 17 bodies, Moravians, Presbyterians, 12 bodies, Protestant Episcopal, 2 bodies, Reformed, 3 bodies, Schwenkfeldians, Social Brethren, Spiritualists, Swedish Evangelical Miss, Covenant Waldenstromians, Unitarians, United Brethren, 2 bodies, Universalists. Total of sects and splits, 139. In the present month, February, Mystery 1. Lind, A.M., has communicated to the Boston Transcript a hopeful article on the solution of the problem of the divided church. Divided is not too violent a term. Subdivided could have been permitted, if he had thought of it. He came near thinking of it, for he mentioned some of the subdivisions himself: the 12 kinds of Presbyterians, the 17 kinds of Methodists, the 13 kinds of Baptists, etc. He overlooked the 12 kinds of Mennonites, and the 22 kinds of Lutherans, but they are in Rev. Mr. Carroll's list. Altogether, 76 splits under 5 flags. The Literary Digest, February 14, is pleased with Mr. Lind's optimistic article, and also with the signs of the times, and perceives that the idea of church unity is in the air. Now then, is not Mrs. Eddy profoundly wise in forbidding, for all time, all explanations of her religion except such as she shall let on to be her own? I think so. I think there can be no doubt of it. In a way, they will be her own. For, no matter which member of her clerical staff shall furnish the explanations, not a line of them will she ever allow to be printed until she shall have approved it, accepted it, copyrighted it, cabbaged it. We may depend on that with a four-ace confidence. The new infallibility, all in proper time Mrs. Eddy's factory will take hold of that commandment, and explain it for good and all. It may be that one member of the shift will vote that the word LL means all. It may be that 10 members of the shift will vote that LL means only a percentage. But it is Mrs. Eddy, not the 11, who will do the deciding. And if she says it is percentage, then percentage it is, forevermore, and that is what I am expecting, for she doesn't sell all herself, nor any considerable part of it, and as regards the poor, she doesn't declare any dividend. But if she says LL means all, then all it is, to the end of time, and no follower of hers will ever be allowed to reconstruct that text, or shrink it, or inflate it, or meddle with it in any way at all. Even today, right here in the beginning, she is the sole person who, in the matter of Christian Science exegesis, is privileged to exploit the spiral twist. The Christian world has two infallibles now. Of equal power? For the present only. When Leo XIII passes to his rest, another infallible will ascend his throne. Others, and yet others, and still others will follow him, and be as infallible as he, and decide questions of doctrine, as long as they may come up, all down the far future. But Mary Baker G. Eddy is the only infallible that will ever occupy the science throne. Many a science pope will succeed her, but she has closed their mouths. They will repeat, and reverently praise and adore her infallibilities, but venture none themselves. In her grave she will still outrank all other popes, be they of what church they may. She will hold the supremest of earthly titles, the infallible with a capital T. Many in the world's history have had a hunger for such nuggets and slices of power as they might reasonably hope to grab out of an empire's or a religion's assets. But Mrs. Eddy is the only person alive, or dead, who has ever struck for the whole of them. For small things she has the eye of a microscope, for large ones the eye of a telescope, and whatever she sees, she wants. Wants it all. The sacred poems, when Mrs. Eddy's acrid revelations, that is the language of the bylaws, are read in public, their authorship must be named. The bylaws twice command this, therefore we mention it twice, to be fair. But it is also commanded that when a member publicly quotes from the poems of our pastor emeritus, the authorship shall be named. For these are sacred too. There are kindly people who may suspect a hidden generosity in that bylaw. They may think it is there to protect the official reader from the suspicion of having written the poems himself. Such do not know Mrs. Eddy. She does an inordinate deal of protecting, but in no distinctly named and specified case in her history has number 2 been the object of it. Instances have been claimed, but they have failed of proof, and even of plausibility. Members shall also instruct their students to look out and advertise the authorship when they read those poems and things. Not on Mrs. Eddy's account, but for the good of our cause. The church edifice, 1. Mrs. Eddy gave the land. It was not of much value at the time, but it is very valuable now. 2. Her people built the mother church edifice on it, at a cost of $250,000. 3. Then they gave the whole property to her. 4. Then she gave it to the board of directors. She is the board of directors. She took it out of one pocket, and put it in the other. 5. Sec. 10 of the deed. Hanover said directors shall determine that it is inexpedient to maintain preaching, reading, or speaking in said church in accordance with the terms of this deed. They are authorized and required to reconvey forthwith said lot of land with the building thereon to Mary Baker G. Eddy, her heirs and assigns forever, by a proper deed of conveyance. She is never careless, never slipshod, about a matter of business. Owning the property through her board of waxworks was safe enough, still it was sound business, to set another grip on it to cover accidents, and she did it. Her Barkers, what a curious name, I wonder if it is copyrighted. Her Barkers persistently advertised to the public her generosity in giving away a piece of land which cost her a trifle, and a $250,000 church which cost her nothing. And they can hardly speak of the unselfishness of it without breaking down and crying, yet they know she gave nothing away, and never intended to. However, such is the human race. Often it does seem such a pity that Noah and his party did not miss the boat. Some of the hostiles think that Mrs. Eddy's idea in protecting this property in the interest of her heirs, and in accumulating a great money fortune, is that she may leave her natural heirs well provided for when she goes. I think it is a mistake. I think she is of late years giving herself large concern about only one interest, her power and glory, and the perpetuation and worship of her name with a capital N. Her church is her pet heir, and I think it will get her wealth. It is the torch which is to light the world, and the ages with her glory. I think she once prized money for the ease and comfort it could bring, the showy vanities it could furnish, and the social promotion it could command. For we have seen that she was born into the world with little ways, and instincts and aspirations and affectations that are duplicates of our own. I do not think her money passion has ever diminished in ferocity. I do not think that she has ever allowed a dollar that had no friends to get by her alive, but I think her reason for wanting it has changed. I think she wants it now to increase and establish and perpetuate her power and glory with, not to add to her comforts and luxuries, not to furnish paint and fuss and feathers for vain display. I think her ambitions have soared away above the fuss and feather stage. She still likes the little shows and vanities, a fact which she exposed in a public utterance 2 or 3 days ago, when she was not noticing, but I think she does not place a large value upon them now. She could build a mighty and far-shining brass-mounted palace, if she wanted to, but she does not do it. She would have had that kind of an ambition in the early scrabbling times. She could go to England today, and be worshipped by earls, and get a comet's attention from the million, if she cared for such things. She would have gone in the early scrabbling days for much less than an earl, and been vain of it, and glad to show off before the remains of the Scotch kin. But those things are very small to her now, next to invisible, observed through the cloud rack from the dizzy summit, where she perches in these great days. She does not want that church property for herself. It is worth but a quarter of $1,000,000, a sum she could call in from her far-spread flocks tomorrow with a lift of her hand. Not a squeeze of it, just a lift. It would come without a murmur, come gratefully, come gladly. And if her glory stood in more need of the money in Boston than it does, where her flocks are propagating it, she would lift the hand, I think. She is still reaching for the dollar, she will continue to reach for it, but not that she may spend it upon herself, not that she may spend it upon charities, not that she may indemnify an early deprivation, and clothe herself in a blaze of North Adams gods, not that she may have. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.